Hi, welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Nin Andrews. Nin Andrews is the author of 12 collections of poetry, including The Book of Orgasms, Sleeping with Houdini, and her latest book, Why God is a Woman. The recipient of two Ohio Arts Council grants, her poems have appeared in many literary reviews and anthologies, including Plowshares, The Paris Review, The Best of the Prose Poem, and four volumes of Best American Poetry. Hi, Nin. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi, Lauren.
So would you like to start by reading us some poems?
I would. I think I'll start by reading from my new book, Why God is a Woman, which is just out from Boa Editions. The book is a collection of prose poems about an imaginary island where genders are reversed and the women rule. So the men are the second sex, the beautiful sex, and they're always worrying about their hair, their appearance, their clothes, and they have to raise the children and keep a nice house. And they're fairly self-explanatory, so I'll just read a few to start us off. On the island where I come from, I remember when I was a boy, my mother would take me to the girls' club after work, where she would drink martinis and tell the ladies how she had so hoped for another girl. "But he's such a darling thing," the ladies would tisk, picking me up in their arms. Dolly the redhead would dance me around the room, my head crushed against her huge breasts. When she was soused, she would reach into my pants with her long fingernails, checking to see if my fruit was ripe. "Hands off, Dolly," my mother would say, swishing me away in her arms. "He's not yours yet." They would laugh. Dolly had a reputation. She was our local fruit picker. Her claim to fame, she had once slept with Julio Vega, our island beauty king. Julio Vega was the name on everyone's lips back then. "Julio Vega, Julio Vega," the woman would sigh and giggle and sing. To become the next Julio Vega was every island boy's dream. Julio Vega. Julio Vega, Julio Vega, his name was on everyone's lips. Julio Vega was the first man on the island to run for president. Not that the islanders would ever elect a man to run our country. After all, the man had only recently won the right to vote back then. But the women loved Julio Vega for his long, dark eyelashes, his curly locks, his luscious thighs displayed in our famous ad for coconut oil on billboards and TV screens across the country. Julio Vega was crowned our island beauty king year after year at the Fall Harvest Festival. Paraded around town, he was the centerpiece in a float of adoring women. Rumor had it that he was even more beautiful in person than on screen. Once a woman met Julio Vega in the skin, my mother said, she was never the same. She would hang on his every word, gesture, and glance. Julio loved the women loving him. That's why he said whatever they wanted to hear, and they nodded and clapped and cheered. "A man's place is at the feet of his woman," he announced when he was running for president. "A man is meant to do physical labor and menial jobs like paving roads, sweeping floors, cleaning latrines, for this is the work God designed for island men. If God had wanted men to do office work, he would have made them less muscular, less angry, less beautiful, less eager for sex and war." The liberal men, of course, were enraged by his words. They were overcome with jealousy of his good looks. But soon they began to dress like Julio, to wear glasses like Julio, even to buy the coconut oil and shampoo Julio Vega was said to use. In this way, the men became Julio men, and the women hummed around them like bees around blossoms before ascending to their glass offices in the sky. On the island where I grew up, the men earned 70 cents for every dollar the women made. The women had little faith in the male work ethic. As my mother explained it, men lack patience, the key to great work. The metaphor she used, a man impregnates a woman in a single night, but he never understands the long months of swelling with child. While the island women worked day and night tending the island's needs, the men worked only the daylight hours, which exhausted them so completely they fell into a deep sleep at the end of the day, never waking to the cries of infants, birds, angels, or the youth who were partying in the streets. This, of course, was not the men's fault. Men, my mother said, can't be blamed for their genetic defects and limited work ethic or abilities. Besides, the best men are those who are satisfied with their traditional island roles. Yet when I was a boy, men marched in the streets, waving signs and demanding equal pay, jobs, and rights. Every few years, the women gave the men a small raise. They hired a few more token men. But when the economy soured, the women stopped hiring or giving raises. They said they were only willing to pay a man what he was worth, not a penny more. The worth of a man was an ongoing island debate. On the island where I come from, the law holds men responsible for all unwanted pregnancies. A man who denies paternity of his own son will be exiled. A man who denies paternity of his daughter can have his balls removed. As a result, many men are unhappy with what they call the women's laws. They talk nostalgically of the good old days when men covered their bodies in cloaks with hoods and never once looked a woman in the eye before marriage. Back then, there was no such thing as a girl taking a guy for a test drive. There was no kicking the tires, no testing the wipers or lights. In those days, a man was considered good enough just because he was alive, because he was, at least as soon as he had a daughter and a wife. Back then, people respected the wishes and commands of the divine.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Nin Andrews, reading from her collection, Why God is a Woman. So, Nin, I'm really interested in sort of the concept of this book. Can you talk a little bit about, like, where that came from or how that happened?
It's been a long process. When I first thought of this book, it was years ago. I was taking a class in Cleveland, at Cleveland State in the middle of the city, and I lived up in the suburbs. And the class would end at like 9 at night, or maybe it was 8:30, I can't remember. And I was afraid to walk to my car. And there were maybe three women, the other members of the class were men. And I remember the men thought, and the women thought it was funny, and I thought, wow, is it really strange that I'm afraid? But I insisted on walking to the car, and I thought how, you know, men don't have that fear. You know, maybe they should. Maybe it's just as dangerous for them, but they don't have that built in. At that time, I was a young mother, raising a daughter and a son, and I started to notice the different ways people interacted with my son because he was a boy, and my daughter because she was a girl. My daughter happened to be very strong-willed, and I found myself wanting to run interference, saying it's okay that she's strong-willed. It's okay that she wants to take control of the situation rather than play second fiddle. I've continued just to sort of observe these differences and to explore them in my mind, and that as a result, you know, I wrote this book.
It's interesting. Yeah, because it deals a lot with sort of like gender stereotypes and how they're viewed. And I like that about the project. Is it hard to sustain a project?
Like actually, for one book? Actually, I still keep thinking, oh, I could have put more in this book.
That's awesome.
I didn't realize how, because you're in your role as a woman or you're in your role as a man, until you step out of it, you don't really see it. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. That's awesome, though, because I find it difficult for me to, like, sustain a project, like a book project that's about something. But that's interesting. Can you read us some more poems?
Sure. I think that these are pretty self-explanatory, so I won't introduce them. I'll just read right through. On the island where I come from, only men with hairless bodies are considered desirable to the opposite sex. As an adolescent, I was so afraid of my body's capacity to grow fur. I watched with horror as curly black hairs took over my back, my chest, my arms, my legs, and created a small thicket above my penis. It was as if a shadow were taking over my body. Sooner or later, I knew I'd have to join the crowds of island men who visited the local salons for monthly grooming sessions. The salons, the hubs of male social activity, were where my father and uncle caught up on the latest gossip and clothing styles. As a boy, I watched them leave the house hairy and grizzled, only to return hours later as soft and smooth as ripe nectarines. On the island where I grew up, The women sat out on their porches at dusk, enjoying the island breeze and watching the men walk past, admiring their hair, their legs, their style. Back then, stretchy pants were all the rage. Some of the men wore tight pants, some wore tighter pants, and some men wore pants so tight, the women wondered if they could breathe. The women, including my mother and sisters, hooted and shouted when a sexy man walked past. "Did you see that guy?" one might ask. "I'd like to pinch his ass." Sometimes when they saw a particularly beautiful set of thighs or buttocks, they clapped and broke into applause. "It's so humiliating," I told my father. "Even my neighbor, Angelina, liked to whistle when an attractive man walked by." "Girls would be girls," my father sighed, "just like God will be God," meaning that nothing I did or said could ever change these facts. On the island where I come from, vagina envy is the most common psychological disorder. Island therapists do their best to cure it, but to no avail. Behind the beard, the beers, the machismo, and the biceps, there lurks many a man who suffers from vagina envy. Those afflicted feel as lost as a rowboat adrift at sea. No one knows the cause of the sickness, though island psychologists blame the early weaning of male children. A boy should be suckled until he is 3 years old. Otherwise, he grows up with an insatiable hunger for a woman's breast and is doomed to live a life of unbearable rage and lust. In cultures where the sickness is rampant, women are despised for their laughter, their wisdom, and their sexuality. The hatred becomes a fire that spreads from man to man. Untreated, it grows until it cannot be contained. Men become so overwhelmed with vagina envy, they dream of burning women and girls at the stake or stoning them in the plaza at the center of town. Some of the symptoms of the disease are subtle. A young man in one study refused to go out at night. He became moody, distant, and rarely saw friends. Alone, he stared at the wall, and when asked if he was okay, he didn't answer. He couldn't. He was drowning in a sorrow so deep, the words would not rise from his throat. Like most men who suffer from vagina envy, he blamed a woman for all that hurt inside, for all the emotions he could not explain, and for his feelings of irreparable loss. There is no cure for vagina envy, though the women on the island assure men that if they lead a good and honest life, they will be reborn as women in the next life. On the island where I come from, the most popular toy for boys is the charming Boberto doll, noted for its exaggerated male attributes, luxurious black hair, and mysterious smile. While some islanders consider these dolls to be a sexist depiction of the male gender, the dolls remain a bestseller, with the average island boy owning at least 7 Bobertos. Toy stores on the island sell Bobertos for every occasion, including the ever-popular holiday Boberto, dressed in hunter green trousers and a crimson silk shirt unbuttoned to the navel to reveal Boberto's island tan and classic muscular silhouette. And the sizzling summer Boberto, dressed in a sporty safari outfit and a matching sun hat. If you pull summer Boberto's drawstring, he transforms into swimmer Boberto in an azure Speedo and flippers. Summer Boberto's accessories include a swim mask, suntan oil, and a diary with a golden key and the words, "I love Angelina," inscribed in tiny letters on every page.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Nin Andrews. Nin, I really like sort of the subtle humor that's in all of your poems. I don't know. I just like that a lot. I want to compliment you on that.
Thank you.
I'm interested in sort of the speaker of these poems. Is it shifting? How do you envision the speaker?
They're all told from the point of view of one man who has been exiled. And he's looking back with both nostalgia and disgust at the life that he lived on the island.
Oh, that's really interesting. Also, you have these poems that sort of have like the same titles throughout.
Yes.
So why is that?
A few of them have actual titles, but they're all his memory. On the island, you know, like, I'm imagining him talking in a bar or to his friends on the island where I grew up. You know, so that's sort of his trigger. That's how he thinks back.
So why the choice to do it from a male perspective of exile instead of like a female perspective?
Well, I wanted to put the shoe on the other foot. Mm. I wanted him to feel what I feel or what women feel when they're the second sex. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So also these poems are all, you said in the beginning that they were all sort of prose poems. How is working with like a prose poem different? Do you feel less constrained, freer, or are the rules different in your mind when you're working with prose?
You know, I think so. I think of prose poetry as the perfect venue for little stories. And this guy is a storyteller. It just lends itself. They're somewhere between prose and poetry. There are elements of poetry built in. But they really lend themselves. They don't contain themselves in smaller lines. They're more expansive. So they're somewhere between the lineated poem.
Yeah, and you can feel like you have more room to grow a narrative, I guess.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's really interesting. I like that Vagina Envy poem.
Thank you.
I'm sure our listeners will like that too. So, was there something that triggered that, or it just sort of...
I've always resented the idea of penis envy. You know, and I was also, my father had always hoped that he would have one more son. He had one boy and four girls, and I was supposed to be George, second son. And for some reason, the doctor had assured him I was going to be a boy, and this is before ultrasound, so I don't know why he would have done that. So
that's a great story.
Yeah. He used to always say, if you kiss your elbow, you're turned into a boy. I would think, I tried because it's impossible, but I would think, do you really think I want to be a boy?
Right. So that's interesting. And I think, you know, we live in a culture right now that sort of rejects a lot of gender stereotypes, but they're real for a lot of people. I mean, still for generations of people that are alive today and people all over the world. So I think it's good to have a work that highlights that or twists it in a way. You know, I don't think it should be something we ignore just because it makes us uncomfortable. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. Not all the poems in the book are simply about gender issues. I had some fun. Some are more surreal, and I just sort of play around. And some just describe the island itself. Or the religion of the island. So this next one is just more fun. On the island where I come from, all the women look like Angelina Jolie. The women like to call themselves Angelina, even if their real names are Rose, Pilar, Isabella, or Felicia. Many claim that Angelina Jolie is from our island, but she doesn't know this because her parents stole her away when she was an infant. The women love to talk about their relationship to Angelina. They say that Angelina is their cousin, their niece, their long-lost child. Like Angelina, they all have hair the color of crow's wings and lips fat from centuries of sucking mollusks from the sand. The women are proud of their heritage and say they are the last humans to emerge from the sea. Their hair smells of seaweed, their skin of low tide. Occasionally, one of our women is born with webbed hands and feet. Like Angelina, our women are fertile. So fertile that a single woman can populate an entire town. Some, according to legend, have populated entire nations. Even if they can have no children of their own, the women adopt them. They adopt lost souls, too, street children, dogs, cats, pigeons, dolphins, angry men. And the sharks who swim close to taste the blood when it flows freely from between their swimming legs, but who rarely bite, are women. Yes, even the sharks are loved by our women. The women know, as only women can, the difference between sharks who open their mouths wide to say, I love you, Angelina, and sharks who are too hungry to know the difference between dinner and love. On the island where I grew up, a favorite legend is the tale of Saint Angelina, our island's founding mother. Saint Angelina, it is said, was once the most desired sex slave in all of Egypt. She was so beautiful, her body was known as the Promised Land, her lips the Holy Chalice, her bush the Burning Bush. Kings came from the east, drawn by the bright star of her beauty. Pharaoh himself lavished gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh upon her. But Pharaoh was troubled by repeated nightmares in which 77 horses, all fat and fine steeds, drowned in a foaming sea, a dream no one could interpret but Angelina, whose gift of prophecy was as renowned as her gift of seduction. But Saint Angelina was crafty and never revealed the true meaning of Pharaoh's dreams. Instead, she waited until God called down to her, "Run, run for your life, and take the other ladies with you." That was the night Angelina freed the slave women, and together they fled from Egypt and eventually discovered the promised land, this island that is sacred to women. But what happened to Pharaoh, you might ask? This is the part of the tale the islanders love best. They say that Pharaoh and his army of 77 horses and 77 chariots chased Angelina and the slave women to the shore of the Red Sea, where Angelina parted the waves with a single touch of her index finger. Then she looked back and waved. Pharaoh, seeing the beautiful Angelina glistening with sweat, her bare breasts touched by the first rays of sunlight, turned instantly into a pillar of lust and melted into the sand. And so did all his men. And this is when every islander who hears the story claps and claps. Another aspect of the poems that I thought up in the more surreal vein is that the men on the island are actually the last descendants of the angels, which is one of the reasons they're so beautiful. And they grow wings. So when they go through puberty, the wings begin to sprout, and that creates problems. So these next two poems are about that. On the island where I grew up, the first signs of puberty happen at night. A boy wakes to feel a fire inside him, like an ache, a hunger, an indefinable wish, followed by the first prickling of wings. It hurts so much when the wings break through the flesh, each wing bone a knife in the skin. Picture it as the sharp beak of a baby bird pecking its shell. Only the shell is a skin full of nerve endings. Then there is the blood, the shame, the need to cover it up so no one will know. This, the boy learns, is how it feels to be a man. Nothing he does, says, or prays can ever make him feel safe from what he has become. On the island where I grew up, pubescent boys wear absorbent pads on their backs when their wings are sprouting. The pads soak up the blood, the leakages occur, and boys often complain that they feel like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. By the age of 16, most wings are fully formed, but in 1 out of 10 cases, one or both wings stay lodged beneath the skin and must be surgically removed. Wing retention is usually caused by poverty or anorexia, for lack of nutrition inhibits proper wing development. Many boys envy their wingless friends who are not seen as sexual targets by island women or foreigners who compare our virgin boys to angels and will pay a high price to be the first to ride them. The house husbands. Most islanders consider childcare the man's job. Men are responsible for raising well-mannered children. If you're going to hang around the house all day, an island woman will tell her spouse, then you can at least take better care of the children. The men complain that they are no longer allowed to use the old techniques, the tried and true for disciplining the young. They long for the good old days when fathers used sleeping potions to quiet their sleeping offspring for a few delicious hours every afternoon. From 3 to 5 p.m., the fathers regained their peace of mind, watched TV, swung on porch swings, and talked with the neighbors. When the children woke, everyone was in a better mood. It seems so harmless, the fathers contend. Those little white masks, doused in chloroform, pressed deeply over a child's nose and mouth, and the immaculate silence that followed. What harm could it have caused? Especially on those endless summer days when the children wake with the sunrise and the cocktail hour threatens never to arrive. There's an underlying theme of this poem, this man who has been exiled from the island, as I said before. And he the beginning of his unhappiness begins when his girlfriend leaves him. So this next poem is about that. After Angelina left me, my father comforted me as best he could. "You're better off without her," he sighed, adding that he had never liked her. She was the wrong kind of girl, always eyeing loose men, catcalling, pressing dollar bills in their pants. "All she wanted was to get into your trousers," he said. "I wish she had. I wished I hadn't refused her advances, claiming I wasn't that kind of man. Just imagining a night in bed with her still makes me sob and wish for extra large wings or some kind of revenge. I was so desperate then. I sought medical advice, asking a doctor for injections I could barely afford. I told the doctor I wanted to win Angelina back. Of course, she agreed, but you know there are risks. I was too young to worry, too stupid to think of anything besides Angelina's soft, wide lips. The island where I grew up, death did not always exist. Death came by boat to the island with the foreigners. Which ones, no one was sure. They say that the Spanish came first, then the English, then the Dutch. They came to take our gold, our land, our souls. When they had stolen everything they could and grew homesick for their own lands, they left. We were never so happy as the day we watched the last of them go. But as the last ship was setting its heavy sails and heading across the bay, several of our native women waved their arms and ran across the water to ask a few last questions of their priest. The priest, standing on the prow of the ship, was so surprised to see the women running on bare feet across the water, he waved his arms in the air in a sign of the cross. At once, the women sank like stones. In this way, the first converts on our island were made. Some of the people on the shore who watched the women sink became converts as well. They too began to die. This is how death came to our island. To this day, there are those who believe in death and those who live forever. It is often debated which is the better way. On the island where I come from, everyone knows it was Adam who ate the apple in the Garden of Eden. The snake had nothing to do with it. Adam didn't even apologize. Instead, he grabbed that apple as soon as he thought God wasn't looking and bit into it greedily, the juice running down his chin. "No, Adam, no," Eve cried. But Adam just grinned and grinned. The sense of wonder he felt then, and pride. How could he explain it? The sweetness on his tongue. The taste of rain, of summer, of rebellion. And the days that followed, when all he wanted was to argue with Eve and to win. "Who needs heaven or God," he asked, "when there is so much on earth to bite?"
The poetry of Nin Andrews. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.